Hi, this is Donnie Bergstrom. I am one half of Fresnolandia that I co-host with Jordan Maddox. I am excited to share that we have won an award for our podcast from the California Journalism Awards in our category, and we're really excited to share that with you all. We won the award specifically for the episode called Homelessness is a Housing Problem. If you remember, it is the episode that we had Clayton Aldern, who's one of the authors of the book of that same title, on the show, along with Jessica Burzak, who's an affordable housing developer located in Fresno, as well as Fresno City Councilmember Miguel Arias. And we had a very lively discussion about the roots of homelessness in Fresno and how we actually get to the bottom of it and what's really needed to solve this problem. We're really excited that we won this award, and we hope that this is the beginning of many more episodes where we can really debate and dive deeper into the roots of a lot of the issues that we face in Fresno. Thanks so much for listening, and we hope that you enjoy the episode as we reshare it today, and we'll see you again next week. Thanks a lot.
Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Dani Bergstrom.
Today we have our third book club with housing scholar Clayton Aldern about his book he co-authored with Greg Colburn called Homelessness is a Housing Problem, How Structural Factors Explain U.S. Patterns, which is one of the best and most clear books I've read on how structural factors contribute and create environments for homelessness to grow and expand. We've also invited Councilmember Miguel Arias, as well as affordable housing developer Jessica Burzak, to discuss how we see these structural issues playing out here in Fresno. One small note before we get into the podcast, we will be moving our release time for new episodes to Tuesday morning at 6 a.m. Pacific Standard Time going forward. Now let's get to our conversation. To start, Clayton, a broad question for you to set the table here, which is, how is homelessness a housing problem, and how did you and Greg set out to prove that?
Yeah, thanks so much for the invite and for that question. I think the motivating question behind this book was, why does a city like Seattle, for example, or indeed perhaps a city like Fresno, see a rate of per capita homelessness much higher than that of, let's say, Chicago, right? Or even Detroit. What is the difference in terms of the policy environment, the economic environment, the sociodemographic environment? What might it be that explains this type of variance? And in particular, not just between Seattle per se or Fresno per se and these other cities, but indeed at the municipal level writ large, what can we understand about the variables that predict rates of homelessness across the country? And when you ask that question, when you seek to explain variance, when you seek to ask, what is it about a given socioeconomic environment that predicts higher rates of homelessness relative to environments that do not produce higher rates of homelessness? The answer that shakes down is that it isn't often the case that individual factors, things like poverty, things like unemployment rates, predict these higher rates of homelessness. Instead, we see structural factors, those that are related to the housing market, things like vacancy rates and indeed absolute levels of rent that predict these higher rates. So we would say when we look at the cities in our study, and we looked at the 30 largest metropolitan areas in the country, we would say that, of course, individual factors matter in terms of a given person's risk profile for experiencing homelessness. Of course, having an extremely low income is a risk factor for experiencing homelessness. And also, it isn't the case that there are simply more people with extremely low incomes in cities that have high rates of homelessness. Instead, we would argue that market conditions exacerbate these risk profiles, right? You have situations in which unaccommodating housing markets accentuate pre-existing individual vulnerabilities. So that's the story that we're seeking to tell here, and we think that's the story that the data support.
Can you explain why it's more important to focus on structural issues versus individual circumstances that would lead someone to become homelessness? I know this is true in Fresno, and I'm sure this is true across the US, but a lot of our conversations tend to focus on everyone's individual circumstances, their mental health situation, and why should we look beyond that?
I think it's important that we're not necessarily privileging one of these modes of analysis over another, right? I think it is essential that we collectively wrap our heads around the extent to which something like an individual vulnerability may increase one's risk of experiencing homelessness. And at the same time, those aren't the only types of risk factors out there when we consider the picture of causality writ large, right? If a policymaker is asking themselves, for example, what can I do, right? If a city council or indeed some other kind of subnational government is looking at the tools at their disposal, I would argue that it would behoove them to consider all possible routes of intervention. And routes of intervention here, very frequently at the subnational and municipal level, aren't defined by individual interventions, right? We don't want to tell individual people how to live their lives, right? And indeed, the tools that are open to policymakers very frequently have structural forces embedded within them, right? These are tools like zoning, for example. And your question about why is it important to consider structural factors at all, I think it's because very frequently, those are the factors that the policymaking community tends to have levers to pull with respect to, without infringing on something like individual liberty. There's a twofold answer from my perspective here. The first is that we really need to be offering ourselves more of that causal space for analysis. We can't just think about individual factors, or we're not allowing ourselves to conduct a proper analysis of the problem. And two, when it comes to solutions, we also just can't focus on individual factors because the tools that are open to policymakers address more than individual vulnerability. And I would argue as well, they should.
One more kind of broad question about the book before we jump into Fresno specific issues, which is towards the end of the book in your solutions section, you break the problem down into three buckets, if you will, or stages. Can you talk about what those three stages are? Because I think it's important if we're talking about solutions to break the problem down into kind of smaller parts or component parts to really understand how we can attack it at different choke points.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think it's important that we're thinking about homelessness, obviously, given the nature of this discussion and the title of the book, as a structural issue. And therefore, policy solutions ought to align with the structural nature of the issue as well. What does that look like in practice? First, I think there's a human component here that we have to consider, right? Very frequently, and I'm sure this is a situation that's familiar to you all in Fresno, the media narrative surrounding homelessness tends to concern these individual factors. And by media, I'm using a broad brush here, and I'm also just describing the types of conversations that we may have with one another on the street, that the narrative around homelessness is one that tends to focus on substance use. It tends to focus on severe mental illness, for example. And again, there's nothing in my research that suggests those factors aren't real and are indeed exacerbating risk factors in terms of one's individual propensity to experience homelessness, right? To lose one's housing, for example, and they're not the whole story. And what I want to focus on in terms of that first bucket is simply the kind of psychological conversation that we're having here around individuality, right? The suggestion that homelessness is an individual problem, a problem of personhood and indeed morality. And I think it's simply not. And I think the evidence suggests that it's not. And to the extent that societally and in the media environment, we can work to shift the narrative such that we're not offering stories that undergird this kind of othering of people who do lose their housing, will do a great service in reorienting the policy conversation toward viable solutions. So first, I think there's a communications set of solutions that are worth discussing. Second, I'd like to offer that it's also worth really thinking critically about systemic responses to the issue. What does that mean in practice? For me, I'm thinking about institutions like coordinated entry that often sponsored by the federal government and instituted by local continuums of care. These types of programs are those that seek to facilitate some kind of crisis response, some kind of centralized crisis response. And what do? They're going to be taking applications on behalf of folks who are looking for housing. They're going to be assessing people for various modes of vulnerability. They're going to be ensuring that a given vulnerability profile is matched with an appropriate type of housing intervention, given some of the underlying risk factors, et cetera, et cetera. Why is something like coordinated entry a useful approach, and why am I bringing it up here? Again, I think this is a systemic approach to the issue, and systems thinking is going to be useful here, because when we think about homelessness as a system, as opposed to a problem of the individual, all of a sudden we can start to think about it from a policymaking perspective as somewhat almost of an engineering problem, right? Because you can think about, and unfortunately, there's a little bit of dehumanizing language here when you stop talking about people and start thinking about systems, but it becomes a problem of flow, right? There are folks who are entering a homelessness crisis response system, and they meet that system through a handful of manners, right? They come to coordinated entry, or they show up in an emergency shelter, for example, right? Maybe there's some kind of outreach member who is conducting street outreach and interfaces with somebody experiencing homelessness, right? There's the flow into the system. Of course, there's also outflow, and that outflow is housing. We think about housing in a couple different manners in a systems mode of thinking. It can include housing interventions that are sponsored by these continuums of care. They can include things like rapid rehousing, permanent supportive housing, any kind of subsidized intervention. And also, we would consider something like just straight up affordable housing, for example, to be part of outflow, right? In an ideal world, somebody who's quote unquote entering the homelessness crisis response system exits that system into permanent housing. Okay, so we're talking about a problem of flow here. And when we think about homelessness from a systems perspective, of course, we're going to be noticing immediately that there are two areas where it's important to invest. We need to think about inflow and we need to think about outflow. And in terms of the inflow conversation, we're talking about prevention. Certainly the crisis response system needs to be bolstered because we don't want people dying on the street, right? It is important to invest in shelter so people are protected from the elements. And the outflow question is important as well, right? We need to be distinguishing between emergency interventions and permanent housing interventions, right? So any kind of budgetary discussion, any conversation about the marginal dollar that's spent on homelessness, I think placing it in the context of this systems perspective in terms of differentiating between inflow and the crisis response and outflow, that to me tends to be a useful tool for orienting some budgetary considerations. The third bucket in terms of solutions is money, right? And mostly I'm talking about money for affordable housing, right? We have seen in this country examples of what it means to invest heavily and rigorously in ending homelessness, and in doing so in a targeted capacity, both through service programs and through, housing interventions. The Veterans Affairs Administration that has done a lot of good work on ending veterans homelessness, for example, comes to mind. And what are the hallmarks of successful investments, whether on that front or elsewhere? Again, we're talking about orders of magnitude higher spending than we tend to see elsewhere when we talk about ending homelessness, right? Very frequently, ending homelessness is tossed around as this highfalutin strategic goal. You see it in a lot of 10-year plans at the municipal level, for example. But the spending that is required to actually do so, to actually reach functional zero, as it were, in terms of that inflow into homelessness, right? The functional zero level of losing one's housing at all, the dollars that are currently on the table just do not match the need. And so maybe it's a little obvious to point out the dollar signs here. The third solution that comes to mind for me is simply money. And in particular, as you've suggested, my book with Greg is a book about supply. So in some sense, it's also perhaps unsurprising that I'm arguing for more money going towards supply, but we really do need more housing. And to the extent that money can help us get there, that's great. Of course, there's also a regulatory conversation to be had, which perhaps we can have that conversation here. But any hurdle that can be swept away in the interest of increasing the supply of affordable housing in the country is going to be a useful tool here.
It In this next section of the podcast, where we have two local guests who are going to join us to have a really interesting conversation, we think about the homelessness problem in Fresno. We have Miguel Arias, who is a city council member in Fresno representing District 3, which includes downtown, Southwest Fresno, and South Tower District. And we have Jessica Burzak, who is the principal and co-owner of Upholdings, which is a local affordable housing development company. Thank you both, Miguel and Jessica, for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Miguel, I'm going to start with you. We've had a lot of activity and policy activity around homelessness in the wake of the Grants Pass Supreme Court decision in early August. Fresno just started enforcing its camping ban. The county also passed its own camping ban, made a crime basically to camp in public spaces. The city has started to clear encampments. Tell us a little bit about the thinking inside City Hall. I know the systemic issues around affordable housing, the tightness of our housing market. Why has that been the focus of clearing encampments at this point?
Yeah, so I'll tell you, I've been on the council. This is my sixth year. I have lived experience with two siblings that were homeless, one for 10 years, one for 4 years, both as a result of sexual abuse and drug addiction that followed. And prior to my arrival on the council, the city had 10 emergency shelter beds for more than 500,000 residents and about 2,500 homeless residents. So clearly the city had not built any kind of supportive infrastructure or solutions towards the emergency shelter. Since then, we have invested more than $400 million, which is not marginal money. That is twice as big as our general fund over the last 4 years. As a result, we've housed more than 8,000 folks, half of which transitioned to permanent housing. And we now operate 840 emergency shelter beds instead of 10. We've given folks at least 2 years to be in a shelter without rent or utility bills, with social services and mental health and drug treatment. We are funding medical services across the city for the unhoused, public restrooms and showers. We essentially executed every service that the homeless advocates and the unsheltered residents have asked for in a significant way. And yet we still have a significant challenge. And what I've learned is that there are subgroups of the unhoused population. Unhoused are generated by being a victim of domestic violence, aging out of the foster care system, being formerly incarcerated in the state of California and being let out, elderly that are on fixed incomes and cannot afford the escalating record rent, those who have significant mental health needs, former sexual pedophiles that cannot be housed near certain areas but are freed, those with severe drug addiction, and of course, people who are just poor as a result of loss of job or low income. But the challenge for the city has been that the last group of folks are not the people that we see on the streets of Fresno still. It's not people who have no income or lost a job or have a tough situation that's temporary. The vast majority that we see in the streets of Fresno today are fall into two categories, significant mental health and severe drug addiction. And these are primarily adults who also in the process commit a series of crimes, from property theft to publicly urinating and doing the restroom everywhere, and who, in my view, are 10% of the population of the unhoused, but are 90% of the challenges that a neighborhood complains about. The reason we've gone to a point of enforcement is we've determined that although we've done as much as we can, 400 million plus in 4 years, approved hundreds of new affordable housing units for the population that we're struggling with the most, if you were to give them housing tomorrow, as we've given them, because these individuals have been through shelters, but they're not ready or unable to engage in the treatment part of their experience, you still have a problem in the public space. And in my view, the introduction of fentanyl and opiates has completely changed the landscape of the unhoused. 5 years ago, an unhoused person would not engage in open drug use, much less in a city bus stop or in front of a school at the entrance of a school door. Today, they do that across the city. They would not defecate in front of a business 5 years ago. Today, they do that on a daily basis. The fentanyl and the opioid epidemic is so severe that it has rewired their mental state that they are not honoring, and they become much more aggressive and violent. And that's the population that we're intending to address with the no camping ordinance. Is, as I've said yesterday, the unhoused have all the rights and privileges of everyone. They don't have any more than a kid waiting for the bus stop to get to school, or somebody trying to walk their dog down the street where the sidewalk is blocked because they're engaging in drug use openly in the middle of the day. That's, I think, in a nutshell, our journey is that we've tried and we've done the helping hand, and there's only so much of that we can do because money isn't infinite. And I don't believe we're going to get to a point of managing this crisis any better until we start addressing the lack of the role of the family unit. This homeless crisis, in my view, it's an American problem. American problem is unique to us. In Mexico, the category of the unhoused that I described, everybody houses them in their own family home, and they have a support system. Here, we've taken the position that it is the role of government to provide all the support systems for somebody who is struggling with being unhoused. And yesterday, I was having lunch with Des Martinez and other folks from the unhoused community. And there is a level of expectation that government will provide you free housing, free utilities, and free food until you're ready to be fully employed, if you're an able-bodied adult. We're not expecting that of an elderly on a fixed income, somebody with a significant mental health needs, but we are expecting that you have to do your part to get yourself out of a situation that's clearly difficult.
And we know that for people who have severe mental health issues, a lot of the solutions, and I know Clayton, you talked about this in the book, permanent supportive housing is a big option for a lot of cities and counties to take on. And Jessica, you build permanent supportive housing. You've had two projects recently that have hit some significant snags, one in the city, one in the county. What are the barriers to getting more permanent supportive housing out into the community, and how do we overcome those?
Yeah, it's interesting listening to this conversation because I'm realizing as a housing provider, we're really stuck between the individual conversations and the structural conversations. Like a proposal to create more housing is a structural solution. It's units that help with the outflow, helps move more and more people into what is the structural answer, right? Statistically, research shows that permanent supportive housing is one of the most effective solutions. But I'm realizing as we're having this conversation, as a provider, we are asked about the individuals. We're not asked about the structure. We are asked who will live there and tell me about the characteristics of the people that might live there. And I'm realizing that's an impossible question. It's felt difficult and it makes creating housing really hard, but I haven't thought about it from that individual versus structural kind of perspective. And so that's ultimately what gets in our way, right? Is structural solutions such as the general plan that call for certain kinds of projects that are there, right? The tools are there for us to move ahead full force. And then we get blocked because of neighbors who don't want a possible type of individual. And I completely agree that the people that we are looking at, that we see in front of the businesses, in front of the schools, that is such a small percentage of the people that need the housing. And that's, I appreciated the part of the book where it's like, we have got to change the narrative on what this solution is doing. Like permanent supportive housing isn't actually addressing the person that's defecating in front of a business. That person needs a higher level of care, right? That person clearly needs more resources than PSH could ever provide. But if we don't keep working on the outflow, there's nowhere for people to keep coming in.
And Jessica, I would affirm your position because what I find myself constantly explaining to my colleagues and to the public is that our inability or unwillingness to act on open crimes being committed by the unhoused because they've been labeled as an unhoused has undercut our ability to convince neighbors to allow affordable housing in their backyard and has resulted in encampments in their front yard. And that's the challenge. In my meeting yesterday with the advocates, my request was allow us to enforce the law equally amongst all residents. We would not allow a teenager to defecate in front of somebody's business. Why are we allowing an adult? Right.
And it's interesting because in PSH, we actually say the same thing. Look, a lease is a lease, right? Like just because you came from homelessness and you live with a disability, you don't not live by the terms of a lease. And I think there is this false perception that permanent supportive housing is housing with no rules, right? And that we're going to be taking the people that the worst that people assume of someone who doesn't have a roof over their head and letting them live with the same behaviors in privately owned housing where people sign independent leases. And I always think, are we asking a single family home builder about the possible behaviors of their home buyers, even if it's affordable home buying, right? What if someone's low income and they're purchasing a home? Would anyone dare to ask about their mental health conditions or their health conditions? And, never.
And typically we're not asking that because we're not subsidizing that project. But once you are requesting a significant subsidy from local government, then you should expect questions about how you're going to operate your facility.
You might be making zoning changes. There might be opportunities for the neighbors to ask, is what I was getting at, right? Anything that goes through a public process invites public response. And I have never heard those kinds of questions unless you identify the population group, which is why I've often felt that it's a HIPAA violation, right? Talking about the possible behaviors of an unknown tenant, right? We don't know who's going to live there. It gets into this illogical narrative around possibilities that are not guaranteed. And it just puts us in a really hard spot to be the structural response, right? Housing providers are a structural response. Like the general plan calls for housing, right? That is a different side than the human services response that the Department of Social Services takes on and that kind of thing. And yet somehow they constantly come back together, right? The conversations get merged.
And I would argue that the reason you're being posed those questions is that the Health and Human Services side is completely silent on this matter. Right? They're completely absent and don't want to engage in the conversation of why haven't we expanded the 5150 high need mental health beds in the county of Fresno in the last 30 years? Nobody wants the conversation, at least not.
Yeah. I think it's fair. I mean, I get asked questions all the time that I'm like, I don't know. I'm just a housing provider, right? Like I can't answer questions about someone with severe trauma and decades of abuse and right, like that is beyond a housing provider. Would we ever ask, right? Again, would we ever ask Granville to talk about those things? No, but this the systems part of this and how many people we have forced into the room that don't work together because they're tasked with different end goals, and yet somehow we're all trying to answer for each other. And I agree, it is messy.
I'm gonna maybe try to complicate this discussion a little bit, in part from my perspective of somebody who was once employed by a human services department, and in part as a statistician who looks at the comparative effectiveness of interventions to reduce rates of homelessness in municipalities. And one thing, council member, that I heard you say is that, right, nobody should have to, for example, come into contact with like fecal matter on the street. That's just true of any resident navigating a city in which they live. And so I think this notion of the right to the city is really important to raise here. I would argue that nobody wants to step on a used syringe in a park. That's true of children. It's true of parents of children. And by the way, it's also true of people who use drugs, right? The person sleeping in the park who's using that syringe doesn't want to step on their neighbor's syringe, right? It's a bad outcome for everyone involved. And so in terms of thinking about the kind of human level of the response here, and this is bringing it back to the notion of othering that I was bringing up earlier, if we're going to have a conversation about people, about individual behaviors, then I think it's important to ground that conversation, as I think you rightfully have, in the experience of the community as a whole, because there are some effects of chronic homelessness that are, of course, harmful to everyone involved, including those people experiencing chronic homelessness. And to the extent that we can orient a conversation around community level impacts, I find that we tend to be able to find a little more common ground in those conversations. The challenge that I see myself rubbing up against here when we're talking about chronic homelessness and severe mental illness and the associated community effects thereof, again, both for housed and unhoused residents. Everything that we know about sweeps is that they tend not to reduce the overall number of unhoused people or encampments, right? People typically move nearby or reestablish camps. In cases in which cities are seeking to sweep an encampment and in doing so offering shelter or housing, very few people who are offered shelter during an encampment sweep accept it. That's for a variety of reasons, right? You mentioned, for example, a different environment in which, I think you said in Mexico, for example, people in these positions tended to have support networks in their families, right? And that was maybe slightly non-existent in the Fresno context. The responsibility fell on the state. In some cases, for people experiencing homelessness, that supportive community is a function of their encampment. And so they may not want to leave the encampment because you're breaking up the supportive community, right? Sweeps can cause a heck of a lot of trauma. They can disrupt connections with service providers, right? People can lose their IDs or their medication, right? That there's this displacement relationship with increased infection rates for various infectious diseases and hospitalizations, right? So it's not a clean story by any stretch of the matter, which is not to suggest that there's never an appropriate conversation to be had around something like relocation in a consensual manner. And also, man, this is really tricky because when I think about severe mental illness, when I think about substance use, I'm also thinking about all the people in the country who live with these conditions and are also housed, right? It's actually, you mentioned the kind of wild disproportionality in terms of thinking about the lack of representation of the subpopulation and the broader unhoused population writ large. It's also true that people with severe mental illness who are unhoused represent the vast minority of people who live with severe mental illness, right? Most of those people are housed. And to think about this set of co-occurring conditions or cofactors or what have you as a particular vulnerability that ought to be addressed through some kind of slightly more aggressive policy solutions here, I think it can be a dangerous conversation sometimes, one that is important to have, and one that I'd, you know, love to hear more of your thoughts on. But it does strike me as...
what I think is important to understand is that sweeps are not designed to reduce homelessness. That's not the intent. Sweeps are designed to address the immediate health and safety danger that those encampments have created. Right. If you've been to Santa Clara Street, if you've been to sometimes the canal embankments and the freeway embankments, the rail line right of ways, just last month, those dozen encampments along the rail line. What were the unhoused with severe mental and drug addiction doing? Removing the actual wood and nails off the rail line in the middle of the night as they're going through their episodes, right? In the canal, they're swimming in the canal as the summer snowpack is melting, and we've lost a couple. So sweeps are designed not to reduce homelessness, but to address the immediate danger that a concentration of encampments in human feces and everything else occurs. And I also want to be clear on one thing. I represent the most liberal part of the city. I think it's fair to say, probably the most liberal council member there is on the dais. And yet I find myself in neighborhood meetings having to convince my neighbors to allow the warming center and cooling center to operate. Not because of the folks who go into the center and are using it, because they're not the threat, but the people that serve or victimize that population. That is what becomes a threat and a safety hazard for the neighborhood. So if we've gone to a point where the most liberal part of the city is saying no more here, we've done our part. Every Amazon package is stolen when the warming center is opening, not by those entering the warming center, but by those trying to serve that population or victimize that population. I think we've reached a point where we're now accommodating that condition to continue for some who need a different intervention. And the only way that we know legally that we can force somebody to begin the recovery process is to incarcerate them, because that's the only way to ensure that they begin the withdrawal process and try to get clean, because they're not doing that in the streets of Fresno.
I'll add, I think, first of all, the encampments conversation really is not a housing conversation. I agree with the council member. If this is going to be an encampments call, I feel like I should get off, because I think the truth is, in the housing world, permanent supportive housing is the most intense thing we can provide. But in the behavioral health world, it's the very bottom. It's where someone goes when they have been through everything that their systems might provide, including inpatient treatment and residential group homes and those kinds of things. Other than the fact that I appreciate the council member saying, we're not trying to end homelessness with encampments. Just let's be clear, shelters are not ending homelessness. They are recharacterizing the type of homelessness and they're hiding it effectively. I think that's true with encampments too. It's a different problem that our community is facing. And in terms of the community response, like the book talks about, I wish, like anything, we could do that. I wish we could have housing conversations be isolated to housing and have this human response piece. Cause I get it. I have kids too. Like, this is a real thing, but it's not the same as housing. And I think, unfortunately, what is a very effective, high quality solution, housing, gets blasphemized, right, by all these other really important, like, human conversations. And going back to the question of, like, how do we think about a structural response? I feel that's one of the most important ones, is changing people's understanding of the amount of problems we have going on. We don't have one problem. We have multiple problems that are being addressed in different ways. And yes, they talk to each other. I'm not pretending they don't. But I don't think we often have the right response for what we're addressing in the moment.
Yeah. And I would add to that, part of our challenge as a city is, in our local context, is we're responsible for providing water, sewer, parks, police, and fire. That's our responsibility by law. State charter clearly indicates that county government provides all health and human services. But the county for generations now has taken the position that they will not expand services. They will not build new facilities, because if they build it, they shall count. And that's been a very effective way for them to limit the growth of that bureaucracy. The only place in which the county has ever demonstrated interest in growing their sphere of capacity is in the law enforcement and judicial side of the operation. It has become the default that the only place you get good mental health treatment is in the county jail. Most of the resources go to the law enforcement arm of the county government. It's the reactive, responsive side versus the health and human side, so the services side.
Or the planning side, or the housing planning side.
They argue about giving 1 cent raise to the employees who are providing support services and home care for the elderly or the poor, while they give 10 and 50% raises for the law enforcement correction side of the house. In the world, in the birthplace of three strikes and you're out, we have historically seen it as the hammer is the only solution that we find. And I have tried for years now to convince folks that we need to provide a helping hand. But after $400 million plus, some folks have rejected that helping hand. And we got to find a way to address them so that we can continue to justify the construction and development of supportive housing, affordable housing in every neighborhood.
And I will go back. The hammer made me think of something, because I agree. I think an interesting thing about working in Fresno is the hammers that the state is putting on Fresno and every other community. And so there's a lot of things that are going to have to happen, right? Like, the Sacramento has some pretty firm opinions on what should be happening locally, including encampments, all the way up through housing mandates and enforceable housing accountability laws that make California's housing landscape very different. And I think that's another way.
Jessica, to be crystal clear, I fully doubt that the state would ever enforce a hammer that they have. They have plenty of, and they've demonstrated no willingness to enforce that on any local jurisdiction.
And we've seen them sue Huntington Beach and all sorts of places and win.
Yeah, that's an easy one. Huntington.
So I have a question for you, council member, because there are a lot of tools beyond, and like you said so clearly, sweeps are not a solution to the crisis, but there are a lot of tools that governments have, and Clayton talked about in the book, that can increase our supply of affordable housing, increasing local funding for a bond, inclusionary zoning, social housing, rent control, you name it. And what do you feel as the self-proclaimed most liberal council member, what's the barriers that you have at City Hall to be pushing more local solutions so that we can get more housing built?
The single largest barrier is that City Hall is still primarily funded by single family market rate developers and market rate multifamily developers who will be the first ones to bite you on any conversation of rent control or any other mitigation. That is a dynamic that we operate under. It is one that's difficult. As a council member who got elected in opposition of the Real Estate Association, the Renters Apartment Association, the Chamber of Commerce, and everyone else in the establishment, I can tell you that what funds campaigns at a local government level in Fresno is still primarily market rate housing developers who are more NIMBYism than any resident that you'll find in the city.
I will say, as we all know, Clovis is now legally mandated to be implementing inclusionary zoning. And it's obviously a lot of the same developers. So I'm really curious and perhaps hopeful for Fresno that Clovis is going to test the market and we'll have a better sense of what's maybe possible to keep that growth. Like, we want business here, but maybe more is possible than has ever been put forward.
And Jessica, you've worked in a lot of other cities outside of Fresno, built a lot of affordable housing in those places. How does your experience in Fresno compare to how you've built in Chicago and other cities?
Not Chicago specifically. That one is a hornet's nest as well. I think I've always said since I was a kid here and heard people talking about Fresno, something about working here is it can often feel like we have big city problems and we are dealing with them in small town ways. And that's just going to have to change, right? The numbers are just too big. They're comparable to numbers entire states see. And my greatest wish has always been that we work more collaboratively, that we develop pipelines, that we just develop policy priorities, put them in writing, and then just open, right? Go, right? Pull those restrictions off, pull those barriers off, Clayton was saying, so that we don't get bogged down with NIMBYism, right? Or those individualistic kind of conversations that can slow down policy priority kind of structural solutions.
And that's a perfect time to transition to some community questions. We put this podcast out to the community to get people's responses about things they were curious about, both from Clayton, but also from all of our guests. And so feel free to respond to any of these. This one is specifically for Clayton to start, though. So this is a person that emailed me and asked a broad question, which is that Fresno is neither San Francisco nor Houston. And those are comparatively in your book, Clayton, you talk about different situations in those Sun Belt versus coastal cities that have very expensive housing markets. But they asked, so how do your ideas match a mid-level city like Fresno? But it's not San Francisco and it's not Houston.
Yeah, it's a great question because we know that the various modes, the various structural modes we have to address homelessness are by definition contingent on the nature of the housing market, right? So there's a reason that something like rapid rehousing works really well in Salt Lake City and experiences more challenges in terms of folks retaining the leases after the subsidy period ends in a city like Seattle. And again, the reason is simply because the housing market is unaccommodating in the latter case, right? So if all of a sudden, after 18 months of a subsidy period, that additional rent income stream disappears for a resident, and maybe they over that subsidy period have increase their income by $800 a month through a variety of benefits and jobs, super duper, that might be okay in Salt Lake City. And in Seattle, or I imagine indeed in Fresno, you're still being thrown to the dogs after that. And so when I think about the appropriateness of housing first solutions, the appropriateness of some of these kind of prescriptive modes of zoning that we're discussing here, various modes of ensuring that there's a larger supply of affordable housing in a given city, of course, they're contingent on a handful of both geographic and economic considerations. What is going to work in Houston probably won't work extrapolated immediately to a city like Fresno. What I do think is worth talking about for a brief moment is, you know, what it takes to build affordable housing. And Jessica, I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir here, but it's really difficult to get this stuff to pencil. It is way harder than it ought to be to build affordable housing. This is true anywhere in the country. And furthermore, Jenny, you'd brought up rent control, for example, earlier. Rent control, I gotta say, I am not the progressive academic or advocate who is necessarily going to be banging the drum of rent control 24/7, because I think we've seen that it can reduce housing supply, it can create market distortions, right? There can be real negative economic impacts thereof. And so when we're thinking about ensuring that there's ample supply writ large, given the challenges that council member you named in terms of the power of the housing lobby, right, the power of the development lobby, I think that we need to be talking about solutions that are offering supply up and down the income spectrum, right? We need just as much in terms of the proportionate response. We need just as much market rate housing as we do affordable housing, because mm-hmm. otherwise, given the presence of something like rent control, or indeed just a lack of supply on the upper end of the income spectrum, you're going to see folks down renting. People, it's like the misallocation problem, tenants staying mm-hmm. in units longer than that don't fit their needs just to keep right. rents low. And the Fresno context specifically, this framing of it as maybe halfway between Houston and San Francisco or something, I can't quite recall the analogy, but I would argue that yes, of course, context specificity matters. And the way to think about the translation of some of these broader ideas about affordability and supply is to get really specific about your housing market, right? Its vacancy rates, the hurdles that exist to building additional units, but also think about how those considerations apply up and down the income spectrum mm-hmm. because we need housing at all levels.
If I may add one point to the affordability, if I may. I grew up in farm worker housing. And back then, 30 years ago, affordable housing meant a 2-3-bedroom house with evaporative cooling, with no dryer, you have clotheslines in the back, you had a washer, minimum landscape. Now an affordable housing unit costs $400,000 per unit. The state expects you to incorporate solar, LED, high-speed internet, every upgrade that you can think possible. And you are literally making the unit far more expensive and keeping people there because they will not get that quality of unit for $500 a month in the marketplace. So we've gone away from this idea of the reason all of us moved out of affordable housing and public housing as kids, it was because in order to have an air conditioner and a dryer, you had to own your own home. In order to make upgrades and landscape and have landscape property, you had to own your own home. Instead, we see these in the motels and the shelters that we operate. We've had somebody in the shelter for 2 years. They've been offered 3 different apartments. They refuse them because they're not the brand new apartment complex that the housing authority built yesterday. And that's what they're expecting to get with their contribution of $300 a month and the mm-hmm. Section 8 contribution of $1,000 a month, right? So we've set this false expectation that if you wait long enough, if you work the system well enough, you're going to get this amazing brand new housing unit that costs $400,000 to build at $300 a month. And that just isn't sustainable.
Yeah, council member, I'm going to do something awful and quote from myself right now. And something we write in the book is that we mandate a minimum level of quality in terms of housing, but fail to provide sufficient resources to households who can't afford the housing constructed or maintained at this standard. So again, I am both a quite progressive housing scholar and also an environmental journalist. And I think environmental review is completely out of control, right? I think a lot of these minimum standards of quality are out of control insofar as they are not tuned to the resources that households can actually provide.
nor developers, for what it's worth. Like, the levels of quality that we're mandated to build, and then we get hammered for why is this so expensive? Because it's mandated. It's just another one of these impossible circles. I wanted to chime in and just, in terms of the original question, Jordan, about but Fresno's different, what I actually think this book does a really good job of explaining that it's not different. Like, you go through every factor, right? Is it weather? Is it liberal policies? Is it a Democratic leaning mayor? It goes all these factors. And I thought it really helped me understand that in Fresno, this is a structural problem. You can go through all these. And then I like that because it goes back to dividing those individual factors. All that stuff exists for those that are dealing with it, right? Generationally impoverished households with predilections for serious mental illness. That is a conversation, but it's different than our problem, because our problem is a housing problem.
We have one more community question that we're going to try to ask. And so we'd love to get into this question of why do some homeless people refuse help? And council member, you alluded to one of the reasons that you've heard, but I'd love to hear from Clayton and Jessica your experiences on this question.
Yeah, I love this question because I'm not really an expert, right? I'm a housing provider. So from my perspective, what we see all the time is people that do want help. We see people, the opposite end of what the council member described, the people that have been in and out of the shelters or that have been on the streets. And when they're given an opportunity, whether it's a revised motel room or a brand new construction unit or whatever it may be, they do want the help. And unfortunately for the narrative of our work, that those success stories aren't what we tell. Like, the majority of people that move into permanent supportive housing do really well. They stabilize, right? They do regain family connections. They re-engage in their community. They become leaders that help new tenants to stabilize. I mean, we see housing stability numbers go up. We see people get insurance and get physically well, right? We see health outcomes. That is the truth of what a housing unit creates to someone who's been living with homelessness. And so the people that don't want it clearly aren't being offered the right magical combination of factors that would meet their complicated sets of traumas. And I think that's the truth. Every single person has complicating factors. Everyone that is being described that needs this ramped up hammer level of help is going to need a really nuanced solution that something as broad as PSH isn't going to provide, right? PSH is actually too low of a level of help for the people that are saying they don't want help, in my experience.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. And in my experience talking to folks who haven't offered any kind of emergency housing assistance or some kind of crisis response intervention through a street outreach team and says no, why do they say no? Here's what I've heard. For example, first of all, you're not getting offered housing, right? Unfortunately, it'd be great if when an outreach member came to an encampment and rolled up in a van and said, hey, tell you what, we're probably going to confiscate this tent, but we've got a single family home for you to move into down the street. The conversation might look a little different. In reality, it's usually, you either got to move or tell you what, here's a shelter bed. And the shelter bed might be 15 miles away, which no big deal. Okay, I can figure that out. Unfortunately, my kid is in school down the street and my doctor is a couple blocks away and I tend to get medication there. So now being 10 miles away from my kid's school and my medical provider, that's probably too challenging giving everything else I got going on right now. So I'm going to say no to this shelter bed in the interest of kind of staying close to these other services that I need. One reason I hear is kind of service proximity and this mismatch between some kind of congregate living solution and other needs at play. Congregate living in its own right, emergency shelter or otherwise, can also be occasionally dangerous, unfortunately, right? And we saw this during the coronavirus pandemic, where you saw rates of the illness spike in these congregate living situations, unsurprisingly, right? If you have a respiratory disease that circulates in the air through aerosols, and you have 100 people living in the same room, right? That's probably not great for respiratory health writ large. And so, right, people know this. People know that there can be an increased risk of infection of various communicable diseases in spaces like shelters. And if something like a private room, whether in a motel or any other kind of subsidized housing unit isn't available and the option is shelter, there are plenty of reasons to be wary of shelter, in particular if you've got some kind of underlying health condition that you're worried about exacerbating. And then I'd mentioned earlier the fact that sweeps and any other kind of mode of displacement of an unhoused community that isn't met with some kind of serious shelter or housing solution can cause a lot of trauma. And you can break up a supportive community. You can disrupt these connections with service providers. And to the extent that a given community operating as such works in a supportive manner, if you've got an offer of service in some capacity that's going to disrupt that community, people say no, I think sometimes for good reason.
If I may, having been a person who's been present when thousands of people have been cleared out from encampments in this city in the last 5 years, here are the three reasons why they reject shelter housing, specifically shelter housing, that would be available to them for at least 2 years. No rent, no utility costs, 2 meals a day. One is they don't want to follow the rules of the shelter. There are two basic rules in the shelter: no drug use on site, and no violence against another individual. The second reason is we don't allow drug use on site. The third reason is safety. And we made the mistake when we opened shelters for the first time that we were combining populations together. So we're putting people that were off the freeways, that some of them were in the business of drug and human trafficking, in with the elderly, in with the mentally ill, in with women and children. So we've now segregated populations to ensure that the elderly are not in the same place as single adults who actively with drug or mental health issues. The reason they don't go to more permanent affordable housing after they get their voucher is the voucher isn't large enough for the quality of housing that they want. In the right location, in the right neighborhood, the housing authority might give them $800. They would have to put in $400 to get that 1,400 unit apartment complex. They don't want to put in the difference, or they can't put in the difference. And permanent housing, again, it's about where is it available? Unfortunately, the vast majority of permanent affordable housing and voucher housing is in the least desired neighborhoods in our city. And some folks don't want to be there. They prefer to be in the more prominent neighborhoods where there's very little inventory of affordable housing. That's why I've come to a conclusion. When you're offering somebody a helping hand and they don't want to follow basic rules of a congregate living space, then they simply say no. And for a variety of reasons, and some of them I would argue are not prepared to be in space with other folks. They feel safer being by themselves than being in a congregate setting with hundreds of people.
I feel like this is as good a place as any to end. We've just scratched the surface. Again, Clayton's book is called Homelessness is a Housing Problem, How Structural Factors Explain U.S. Patterns. Thank you, Jessica, Miguel, and Clayton for joining us. This has been a great conversation, and I know it's going to inform our listeners about the nuances of the discussion around homelessness. This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan, and our song comes from Stateless Rat.